This is the Tax Update Podcast for March 10, 2008. This week, Risky Business LLC Debt Restoration Provision fails to provide at-risk status. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the supporting audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we take a look at a decision where the tax court was reversed by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case of Hubert Enterprises versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2008-46, to determine the effect of an LLC's operating agreement debt restoration obligation to meet the test under or outlined by the Sixth Circuit. The tax court gave us their answer this week about how they sought to apply that question and how to deal with deficit restoration obligations in an LLC and their impact on the at-risk provisions under the rules applicable in the Sixth Circuit. Now, in the original Hubert case, 125 TC73, the tax court had decided that the operating agreement's debt restoration obligation was ineffective in creating at-risk status for recourse debt, since it applied only upon liquidation of a member's interest. Since no liquidation had actually occurred in years in question, the tax court held that the provision was ineffective in creating at-risk status. The Sixth Circuit noted, the tax court's opinion failed to address whether or not economic circumstances beyond the control of the members might force liquidation of their interest, thus causing the deficit restoration obligation to operate in a manner that might cause the members of the LLC to become liable for a portion of the LLC's obligations. Now, it's important to note the Sixth Circuit test is easier for a taxpayer to clear than the hurdles given in other circuits, including the Ninth. In those circuits, the test is where the taxpayer, whether a transaction has been structured to avoid a realistic possibility the taxpayer would have to make payment, based on economic reality analysis. CCH's tax resource consultant cites cases from the Ninth Circuit, the Eighth, as well as a published tax court decision affirmed by the 11th Circuit. And in two of these cases, the Supreme Court denied certiorari when the losing party attempted to appeal its way up. Now, even applying the Sixth Court's position, the tax court on retrying the case held that the deficit restoration obligation in the case at hand still failed to provide at risk for the taxpayers involved, that therefore they were not at risk for the debt that was allocated to them and could not claim losses against that debt under 465. And it should be noted that an agreement that won't pass muster under the Sixth Circuit's test really isn't likely to have any chance anywhere else. So it's important to understand what was the problem with this agreement and to deal with the general issue about how LLCs deal with the at-risk issues. Remember, one of the key concepts of a limited liability company is the limitation of liability for the owners or members of the LLC for the debts of the entity. Now, that means when we make those changes and we change the structure, our liability for the debt may change. And while the basis rules for partnerships continue to operate, as they always would with this LLC, the problem we run into is that the at-risk rules now may come into play and block us from being able to take deductions due to the fact that we won't be at risk for the amounts in question. Now, at-risk is governed by Section 465 of the Internal Revenue Code. Losses are restricted to amounts at risk by Section 465A, and a determination of what exactly is, therefore, at risk is governed by 465B. Now, the amounts at risk fall into one of two categories. The amount of money and the adjusted basis of other property contributed by the taxpayer to the activities is the first part of your at-risk amount. And then amounts borrowed with respect to the activity that meets the requirements of 465B2 are the other provisions that meet the requirements. Now, the real question today is going to deal with those other amounts borrowed and whether we meet the requirements of Section 465(b)(2). Borrowed funds have to fall into one of two categories to be qualified as at-risk borrowing. Either the taxpayer must be personally liable for the repayment of such amount, or they have pledged property other than property used in the activity as securities for such borrowed amount, and that's to the extent of the net fair market value of the taxpayer's interest in such property. We have to establish one of those two items. In the particular case today, we're going to deal with whether or not there was personal liability for the repayment of the amount to generate at risk. As well, overriding this, any debt for which the taxpayer is protected against loss by non-recourse financing, guarantees, stop-loss agreements, or other similar arrangements is not considered an amount at risk. And there are a number of other modifications to at risk we have to consider. Borrowings from related parties generally are not considered amounts at risk. Borrowings from parties with an interest in the activity also not generally considered an amount at risk. Also, if we have used those borrowings in prior years to support deductions for at-risk purposes, we can't use them any longer. That is, if we use them this year to support a deduction, then we have to reduce our amount at risk by the amount that we had used up the debt to allow us a deduction for at-risk. And qualified non-recourse financing, which is that special category that we find in real estate activities, is considered an amount at risk that would otherwise fail the test. As noted, key characteristic of a limited liability company is that generally the members of the LLC are not liable for the debts of the LLC. And that would create a real issue with at risk, because obviously if we're not liable for the debts, we're not going to be able to show personal liability. The question in the Hubert Enterprises case is whether modifications made to the operating agreement serve to override this effect for recourse debt of the LLC and create that personal liability needed to have the subject amounts be considered amounts at risk. Let's take a look at the Hubert facts. The limited liability company in Hubert first had an operating agreement that stated, in accordance with the laws of Wyoming under which it was formed, that no member shall be liable as such for liabilities of the company. That clearly means that we're not liable for any debt incurred solely by the company itself. Now, however, the bad news was it turns out the members needed that debt to be at risk for purposes of deducting losses from operations for the fiscal years ended July 31st, 2000 and July 31st, 2001. On March 28th, 2001, apparently after discovering this fact, or as well issues under the provisions of substantial economic effect regulations for capital account maintenance under Section 704, remember we have to have substantial economic effect in order for the allocations, any special allocations, to be given effect under the tax law. And one of the key components of the regulations under 704 requires the maintenance of capital accounts in accordance with those regulations to be able to get ourselves a safe harbor of the substantial economic effects test. One of our key issues there has to deal with how we deal with deficit obligations, deficits in capital accounts, and where there is an obligation on the part of the partner to restore a deficit. So for the July 31st, 2000 fiscal year, the operating agreement was retroactively revised, essentially effective January 1st, 2000, to provide no member is required to make additional capital contributions. Now note, that revision took place on March 28th of 2001. Prior to the extended due date for filing that July 31st, 2000 tax return, but after the original due date, that becomes crucial in considering whether or not this change is valid for the year July 31st, 2000. However, the provision we added had the following provision added in there that becomes significant. Deficit capital account restoration. If any partner has a deficit capital account following the liquidation of his, her, or its interest in the partnership, then he, she, or it shall restore the amount of such deficit balance to the partnership by the end of such taxable year or if later within 90 days after the date of such liquidation, for payment to creditors or distribution to the partners with positive capital account balances. Now, those of you who are aware of the Section 704 regulations will note that that's essentially a very standard 704 recital that those with negative account balances are going to restore the balance and the amounts are going to be available to go to those with positive balances. The revised agreement also contained a provision regarding third-party creditors that stated nothing expressed or implied in this agreement is intended or shall be construed to confer upon or give any persons any other person or entity other than the parties or their successors in interest in accordance with the provision of this agreement, any rights or remedies hereunder or by reason hereof. That would also prove to be a significant provision the court's going to focus on. Now, the tax court pretty quickly dealt with the first year under consideration by referring to Section 761C, and this is a provision we need to keep in mind when our clients want to change the partnership agreement. While partnership agreements and, by extension, LLC operating agreements for entities operating as partnerships for tax purposes, which are LLCs, can be modified after the year end, the effect of the modification is governed by Section 761C. And that provides that a partnership agreement includes any modifications of the partnership agreement made prior to or at the time prescribed by law for the filing of the partnership return for the taxable year, not including extensions, which are agreed to by all partners or which are adopted in such other manner as may be provided by the partnership agreement. The July 31st, 2000 return was due on November 15th of 2000. Now, the modification stated this agreement or this change is to be made as if retroactive to January 1st, 2000. The tax court held that the amendment's purported retroactive effect of the earlier year does not comport with the annual accounting system of federal income taxation. Under that system, the amount of the income tax payable for a taxable year is generally determined on the basis of those events happening or circumstances present during that year. While 761C allows us to impact that for a short time period after the end of the year, that time period had passed. And merely reciting that this document is to be treated as if it were in effect on January 1st, 2000 wasn't good enough to somehow magically transform this amendment to the operating agreement into one that would have effect for the year ended July 31st, 2000. Given that obviously there were no liabilities for the debts of the LLC by the individual members of the LLC due to the provision of the LLC operating agreement and the fact that nobody had any other way of, the creditors had no other way of getting outside of the LLC to attach assets of the individual members, the year July 31st, 2000 could be rapidly dealt with and we're done with that year and any deduction of losses. Now, the question becomes, well, what about the July 31st, 2001 return? Because the modification made in March of 2001 was clearly made well before the due date, in fact, well before the end of the year of the July 31st, 2000 tax return. Did these changes create at-risk amounts for the owners, for the members in the LLC? Now, the tax court looked at the impact of provisions in question, and it applied the state law in its analysis of whether or not members of the LLC would be payers of last resort. Because under the Sixth Circuit test, we look to whether or not the members of the LLC could be made payers of last resort. The taxpayers argued that Wyoming state law, the law of the state under which the LLC was formed, after the adoption of revised operating agreement, made them liable. The tax court, to quote the tax court's recitation of their argument, petitioners assert that Wyoming statutes sections 17, 15, 121A and C allow a member of the limited liability company to promise to contribute additional capital to the company and permits a creditor of the company to enforce that promise in order to receive payment on a debt owed to the creditor by the company. Now, the taxpayers claim the changes made to their agreement would have allowed a creditor to force a member to pay the debt in question should the LLC default. Since, as we remember, the default, the provision provided that if at when a person's interest is redeemed, there is a negative capital balance, they have to place their money back in to restore that negative back to an equal level. Now, the court, in looking at the provision, notes, though, there are two requirements that must be met to force a member to make a payment to the LLC under this agreement. The member must liquidate its interest in the LLC, and the member must have a deficit in its capital account after such liquidation. The court, in a footnote, indicates that the fundamental assumption that taxpayers are making that the court believes is erroneous after analyzing the Wyoming state law, and there's an assumption that once removed causes a major problem in arriving and finding the taxpayers are at risk. To quote the court, petitioner apparently assumes in a worst-case scenario that the member would liquidate its interest in the LLC and then have a deficit capital account triggering the deficit restoration obligation. The court disagrees with that assumption. As stated herein, their member's liquidation of its interest in the LLC is left up to the member itself to determine they want to liquidate their interest. And we do not assume that the member on its own would liquidate its interest in the LLC if it was detrimental for the member to do so. In other words, as the court discusses, the LLC could not be made to liquidate by a creditor in any circumstances, not even by a creditor that forced the LLC into receivership or bankruptcy. And if you don't force a liquidation, the provision isn't triggered. And with no liquidation, there is no requirement to restore the capital account. The tax court is going to hold, essentially, that because of that, they are not the payer of last resort. A creditor has no rights to get in here. The court gives the following worst-case scenario analysis. In a worst-case scenario, the member is not a payer of last resort as to the recourse debt. In such a scenario, the LLC defaults on the debt without any assets to pay off the debt. The default, however, does not mean that the recourse creditor can simply turn to this member to collect any part of the debt. The obligation under the deficit restoration obligation required in part by the member liquidate its interest in the LLC and the LLC's default in its payment of recourse debt does not trigger a liquidation of the interest in the LLC or even of the LLC itself. Nor in a worst case scenario could the recourse creditor recover directly or compel from the member or compel a dissolution of the LLC to force a liquidation of the member's interest in the LLC. The revised operating agreement states that the LLC shall be liquidated upon its dissolution, and such a dissolution occurs only as provided by the Wyoming LLC Act. Under that act, the dissolution of the limited liability company occurs only upon the happening of one of three events, none of which is the company's default on payment of a debt. Thus, the LLC's default in its obligation to repay the recourse note would not entitle that creditor to compel the dissolution of the LLC. The deficit restoration obligation would not apply to the member if the LLC defaulted on its debt and the member had a positive capital account following liquidation of its interest in the limited liability company. Given that the deficit restoration obligation requires additional capital contribution only when a member has a deficit capital account following the liquidation of its interest in the LLC and that no creditor could compel liquidation of the member's interest, we conclude that the member is not a payer of last resort because the member is not personally liable for repayment of any of the debt within the meaning of Section 465B2A. In other words, the court concludes that the member is not personally liable for repayment of any of the LLC's debt, recourse debt, because the member's obligation to contribute additional funds to the LLC is not unavoidable in that the member can simply avoid contributing capital under the deficit restoration obligation by simply not liquidating. The LLC statute for dissolution provides for it to occur when one of three events take place. That is when, and this is going on now describing how that statute works and the way the court kind of outlines it, when the period fixed for the duration of limited liability company shall expire, that's not impacted by this, by unanimous written agreement of all members, well, they're not going to agree, or upon the death, retirement, resignation, expulsion, bankruptcy, dissolution of a member, or the occurrence of any event which terminates company, continuing membership of a member in limited liability company, unless the business of limited liability company is continued by the consent of all remaining members under a right to do so stated in the Articles of Organization Limited Liability Company. The court noted that the revised operating agreement does provide for the right to continue the entity in the third event. And the court found no Wyoming provision that would have allowed a creditor to force a dissolution of the LLC for a debt of the LLC, though it did note that there was a provision that if there was a debt of the member, we could go back in the other direction. But as the court notes, that's the wrong direction. If a member defaults on a debt, we can force the LLC dissolution to pay off the member's debt, but we can't force the LLC's dissolution when it owes a debt. In order to trigger this liquidation provision, the catch is, as the court notes, the operation is just the wrong way. The debt's on the wrong side of the wall. Without a method to force a dissolution, the creditor can't get to the provision that would require a restoration of negative capital account balance. And the court noted it seemed highly unlikely that a member is going to voluntarily consent to make such a dissolution in a circumstance where doing so is the only thing that would subject them to having to make a contribution that otherwise is not required. The court also, as an aside, expressed concern that the provision was not directly linked to the debt. That even if the deficit restoration obligation is triggered, the agreement does not limit the use of funds contributed to paying the debts in question. It allowed the amounts to be used to pay members of positive capital accounts, and that's a provision clearly in the agreement to deal with the Section 704 capital account maintenance regulations. In fact, the court notes the routine use of deficit restoration obligations for Section 704 purposes and indicates – As we have stated, a deficit restoration obligation is routinely inserted into a partnership agreement to meet the substantial economic effect requirements of Section 704B. If a member of a limited liability company is automatically at risk for repayment of the company's recourse debt by simply inserting a deficit restoration obligation in the operating agreement in order to meet the requirements of Section 704B, then the at-risk rules of Section 465 have little purpose in that seemingly every member of a limited liability company is at risk for repayment of the company's recourse debt. What that makes clear is, at least in the tax court's view, merely complying with the requirements for 704 to restore a deficit capital, to restore a deficit capital account, having that provision in your operating agreement that deficit accounts must be restored, will not give you at-risk coverage for LLC members. And that's something that I suspect a number of practitioners may have indirectly presumed would be true, that, you know, well, they have to restore their deficit accounts, therefore they must be at risk. As the tax court notes, that's not really your analysis. Your analysis is really, from the Sixth Circuit standpoint, whether or not the taxpayer could be forced to repay the debt if the creditor can make it happen. If the creditor cannot make it happen, the fact that the partner might have to restore a deficit capital obligation isn't going to make them necessarily the payer of last resort. As well, remember, outside the Sixth Circuit, our real test is whether we have to run an economic reality analysis and determine not only whether they could be forced to pay, but is there any realistic probability that that would happen? And in that event, then we still don't have amounts at risk, and at risk is a potential problem. Now, this has been the Tax Update for March the 10th, 2008. The Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to go there and take a look at the items they offer and the newsletters they offer for those of you in tax practice. This has been the Tax Update.